Okay, so our next speaker is Peter Salling, and he's the Associate Director for Agriculture and Volunteer Programs with Winrock International. If you're not familiar with them, they're kind of a split location. They're based originally in Arkansas, but they now also have offices in Washington. And he's going to speak to us on a little bit different sort of program than just farmer to farmer. So thank you.
Yeah, and thanks, Steve. As Steve said, Winrock is also part of the Farmer to Farmer program, but I thought that for my talk here I would broaden it a little bit and talk about how we integrate the skilled expertise into and kind of, Steve used the term, I think, helicopter development and how we manage that through a Farmer to Farmer program. But in this case, we're talking about a program where we're in country for 5 years, and we have primarily local staff and are implementing that program and what that looks like. And there are a couple things that are interesting about this particular program. One is I wanted to use it in part because we're working with CNFA on it as well as with UC Davis. And then also because the focus of this program is on three value chains, but including horticulture. But it's really looking at it through a youth lens and how we engage young people in agriculture, and in particular how we can develop the horticulture sector in Guinea by working through young people, and what are the kind of some of the challenges of that and how we're going about it. So I'm going to start with just a little bit about Winrock. I'm not sure if anyone is familiar. I know a couple people actually are familiar with Winrock. We are based in Little Rock, Arkansas. We were started by Winthrop Rockefeller, who I describe as the black sheep of the Rockefeller brothers, because rather than going into banking or business, he moved to Arkansas and started a farm. And he still became governor of Arkansas, so he did okay for himself. But our mission really grows out of that farm. And for a long time, Winrock International was headquartered at that farm. And so these three areas here, Empower the Disadvantaged is our civil society and education work. We do a lot of counter-trafficking in persons, education, particularly education for girls. And then on increased economic opportunity is really our agriculture and enterprise development section. I'm going to be honest up front. Although I'm in our ag unit, I am not much of an Aggie. I really come at it more from the enterprise development side. And then sustained natural resources is we do a lot of work on climate change mitigation and adaptation. And importantly for Winrock, we have programs both in the United States and internationally. So I'm on the international side, but our activities range from economic development in the Mississippi Delta. We have actually a makerspace and innovation lab in Little Rock. So it really runs the gamut. Our global reach, we are in 49 countries, currently have about 220 projects, give or take a couple. As Steve said, the Farmer to Farmer, for instance, ended yesterday. Today I'm going to talk to you about one of our programs in Guinea. I won't ask anyone if they can point out Guinea on a map, but it's a small country in West Africa. Really quickly on our Farmer to Farmer, Winrock has been part of the Farmer to Farmer program since 1991. Roughly 6,300 volunteers on 5,200 assignments. One thing that Steve didn't mention is when we talk about volunteers, as he said, we organize the logistics, we pay for flights, for visas, any of those costs, but we ask the volunteers to volunteer their time. And so when we report to the U.S. government and when we talk about the value of that time, we are able to actually put a number on that. And then our volunteers, as I think John knows well, is often actually make additional donations to the program. So sometimes it can be textbooks, sometimes it can be training materials, equipment, things like that. And that's really entirely up to the volunteer. Our current programs as of yesterday, one in Asia, that was in Bangladesh, Nepal, and Myanmar, and it focused on ag education, youth, and rural development. And then the one that we are going to be continuing is in West Africa, focused on, again, on ag education and rural livelihoods. And in addition to the current program, which is Guinea, Nigeria, and Senegal, the next program will also include Liberia, one of the other countries,
Nigeria, Ghana,
and Mali. Mali is the last one.
Mali, yeah. And there's another one. It's six.
And Liberia.
Okay.
Yeah. So pivoting to the Guinea, and here's the guy in back there is actually one of the UC Davis employees, and you see him here with the solar dryer that they're doing. And on this program, we were really it's funded by USAID. We were really tasked with how do we engage young people in agriculture, with a heavy emphasis on horticulture. And the way that we're really doing that is through technologies and integrating technologies. And the important thing here is when we're talking about technologies, I walked through the booths out in the ballroom here, and there's a lot of really advanced technologies around sensors and you know, different things like that. And we certainly integrate many of those technologies in our programs. In a country like Guinea, where you still have unreliable cell service, unreliable electricity, I'm sure Aaron's heard about the difficulties of internet at our office site there. When we talk about technologies, we're often talking about something really simple. This solar dryer is a fairly simple machine, which Aaron can tell you a lot more about, but it's a few pieces of wood and plastic, and they're able to develop a business around this. And so we're not talking about really kind of advanced ICT stuff. And why are we focusing on young people in Guinea? Our goal is to modernize the agriculture sector there and to create economic opportunity. But why are we doing that through young people? When we talk about youth, this varies by country. In Guinea, we're generally talking about aged 18 to 35. That pains me a little bit because since this project started, I aged out of the youth demographic. So I say that we can fudge that number a little bit. The average age of the population is 24, so there's a bit of a youth bulge, but the average age of the farmer is 60. It's not all that different from the United States. The farming population in Guinea is aging. A lot of young people, I'll get in a second about that. It's rapidly urbanizing. This is across sub-Saharan Africa that young people are moving to the city. They look at the farm as there's a lot of smallholder agriculture. In Guinea, you're talking about like under 2 hectares. They don't see a lot of economic opportunity there. They see their parents. They haven't been able to move up in smallholder agriculture. They see their grandparents haven't been able to move up in smallholder agriculture. And so, you know, they have access to transportation now. They have access to cell phone service, the internet. They're moving to the city and away from agriculture. At the same time, the economy is still reliant on agriculture. Guinea's economy is something like 80% reliant on agriculture. And then for young people in particular, there's a lot of barriers to entry into the agriculture sector. They don't have access to land. They don't have access to they don't have decision-making power. There are a lot of things that restrict them from entering the sector. So what are we doing about it? As I said, the SMART program is Guinea SMART. It's strengthening market-led agricultural research, technology, and education. We're working alongside another program implemented by CNFA called SAVVY. We thought we were really cute when we were designing these programs, and we called them SMART and SAVVY. And it's focused, between the two programs, it's focused on 6 objectives. One is agriculture education and training. So working within the universities, within the vocational schools there to improve the quality of agriculture education, as well as informal education, and that's working through things like producer groups and federations to ensure that people have access to that. Extension and advisory services is both the government extension as well as sort of fee-for-service type advisory services. Research and development, I really call that, and that's where we're going to focus, I'll focus the rest of this talk, is I call that technology commercialization. So it's integrating technologies into the value chains. Access to finance is linking people with financing, primarily microfinance, some banking, but the challenge there for farmers is, again, many of them are smallholders. They don't have access to, they don't have a financial history, financial records. Banks don't have rural branches there. So it's primarily linking them with things like mobile money, which is pretty prevalent, as well as to microfinance institutions. Market access is, linking their product to the market. As you can imagine, in Guinea, the roads are pretty bad. Our project headquarters is anywhere from about an 8 to 12-hour drive from the airport. It is about 300 kilometers, and it's because it's a 2-lane road that every car and truck travels on the same road, and in the rainy season, there's no road there. And then input supply, so improving the quality of inputs. Our three value chains are horticulture, rice, and livestock. And again, we're looking at this through a youth lens. So this graphic here is really just for the SMART program. And the idea is that we are working, we're trying to be the link between the private sector, which does include private sector input suppliers and producers and some large farmers, along with the farmers and then the research institutions, and really be that link between them so that we can make sure that those three elements of the sector are speaking to each other and are working together. And within that, through that youth lens, we have a program called Avenir. I'm not sure if anyone in the room speaks French, but we, again, we're pretty good with the acronym. So Avenir means future, but in this case, it's an acronym for an apprenticeship program. The idea is that part of what's limiting young people in entering the ag sector is actually access to experience. That when you think about how you started out in your career, you probably had an internship or a fellowship. You had that opportunity to work under someone and to grow, and the opportunity, honestly, to fail and to learn from that failure. In the ag sector, they don't have that. If they're fortunate, they go to the single ag university. When they graduate from the ag university, I was in a room once where we asked them, what do you want to do when you graduate from this university? And then we said, do you want to work in the private sector? And a couple hands went up. We said, do you want to work at the university? And a few hands went up. We said, do you want to work in the government? And every single hand in the room went up. The government is the best job going and the most stable and most reliable, and which is still to say you may not get paid some months, but it's considered a long-term and essentially a lifetime appointment once you're in the government. So we're trying to provide people opportunities in the sector. What the training looks like is we have a one-month foundational training that's really focused on a few things. The thing that they don't get at the ag university is business management training. So how do you treat your farm or your activity as a business? How do you manage that business? How do you maintain financial records? How do you research clients and identify clients and market your business? Those really kind of foundational business skills that allows them to take the ag skills that they have and apply them in the marketplace. And then they do a six-month apprenticeship. We put them with a private sector institution, or with a few lucky ones, they actually did theirs with UC Davis and with the program there. So we put them with an institution where they can actually work alongside that institution, get some work experience, develop a mentoring relationship with someone in that institution. But it's a little bit of a Trojan horse to put them in there, because at the same time that they're working for that business, we're pushing technologies out through them. So we're kind of giving them first access to a technology or to a practice and teaching them how to implement it with that business, with the idea that that business is going to carry that forward when that six-month apprenticeship ends. And then at the end, they develop business plans. They're all asked to develop a business plan. The way that I look at it is, best case scenario, they actually get hired by that business. It means that we've put them in the private sector, they have shown value to that business, and then that business can hire them on to continue that work, and that the business can afford to hire them on. But we also are really pushing what we call agripreneurship. The idea is that we want them to be able to start a business and to carry that business forward. And then we have a business competition. It's not all that different from Shark Tank. They have to get up. They have to make a pitch. They have to defend that pitch. They submit their business plan. It's reviewed by a committee that includes both our project and the private sector and evaluated. And then some receive some startup funding that way. The rest are we partner. Actually, CNFA is partnered with an MFI. And so we work with the MFI to try to get them in a position to receive financing for their business. Here are a couple agripreneurs. And as I say, when we talk about how we engage young people in agriculture and how we battle that idea that there's no opportunity there, we really focus on technology. We're giving them first access to technologies that don't exist in Guinea. You see them here that every Avenir gets a tablet. For us, a $200 tablet is a pretty small investment. For them, it's an incredible tool. We load a few programs on it. We load extension videos and things like that on it, so that when they're out in the field or when they're in a a comptoir, an input supply store, or an agri-dealer store, they're able to sell that product using their tablets. They produce their own photos and videos on how to apply fertilizer, safety with safety measures in applying pesticides, things like that. So they're really able to use that tablet for a lot. They also collect client data. And again, that they can then use that data to evaluate the market. We help them with that. All of it gets aggregated in our system. And so we can really use that information to determine where we should be working, where there's opportunity for them. And then, as I said, we give them access to new technologies, and then we integrate those technologies. And again, to talk about sort of a simple technology in horticulture here, you see over his shoulder we have a raised bed garden. Very simple thing, not particularly advanced, but something that people are willing and able to pay for their farm, or raised bed nursery for seedlings. And so what types of technologies are we talking about? There are a few on here reference UC Davis on. So one is the Mobi pump. You can see in the photos here that it is an irrigation pump that hooks up to a dirt bike. Everyone gets around on a small motorbike. And so this pump, it's about $100 for the kit. You can hook it up using the engine of the motorbike as the pump. And so we were able to bring these in from Burkina Faso. They have we were able to arrange it with the manufacturer to do it based on consignment. And that's really key because it means that the young people don't have to put money up front to sell this technology. It means that they pay the money as they sell it. A few others, I showed you the UC Davis solar dryer. We also have a forced air dryer that can run on a solar battery. The raised bed nurseries. Pineapple suckers is a propagation technique that essentially allows us to replicate or to propagate pineapple much more quickly than from seed and much more reliably. You saw the tablets. Some of it is just improved varietals, particularly in the rice sector. One that I left off here is plastic mulch. Again, not a particularly advanced technology as a sheet of plastic, but we were able to go to a local manufacturer in Guinea and get them to produce a biodegradable plastic mulch that's now available in the market cheaper than importing it from the U.S. or wherever. And then the CoolBot is really a neat technology that UC Davis has developed that is able to develop cold storage using an air conditioning unit that is fairly common in Guinea. So, and how do we integrate international expertise into this? I mentioned that most of our staff are local staff, but there are a few ways that if people in the room are interested to be involved in this type of program. One is, as Steve said, is volunteers. The other is we hire consultants frequently, experts in a specific thing. For instance, pineapple. We don't have, there is not a lot of pineapple expertise. They have a partnership with a French company. But in terms of things like how to propagate it and things like that, we bring in additional expertise to help with that. Our staff aren't as familiar with it. And then the other way is I suspect some of you in the room are researchers. Certainly if you have research projects and are interested in learning more about our programs, not just Guinea, anywhere, we frequently partner with research projects because we have the infrastructure there. We have the office. We have the staff. And any way that we can leverage investments elsewhere, we're happy to do that. And then the other thing I'll say is private sector. And bringing in people, whether Guinea, anywhere really, from the private sector to look at what we're able to do there, what local farmers are able to do, and the networks. And we're always very interested in that. In terms of the types of expertise, we're looking at expertise in specific crops and value chains. Organizational development is a big one. As I said, with our Avenir, we're training them on business skills and market analysis. And that's true. That's needed not just by young entrepreneurs. It's needed by everyone in the country. Every organization, we do a lot of work with the Pineapple Federation and do a lot of work with them on that. Business skills and management, and then technology and integrating technology into this. So I think that's the overview. I'm happy to take questions. Yeah?
How did you recruit these volunteers?
How do Sure. So, yeah, so the question was, how do we recruit volunteers? And Steve, you may also want to chime in on this. We have a strong network of volunteers. People can sign up through our website. We do a lot of outreach at conferences like this, events like this. And then also, as Steve said, all of our volunteer assignments are very much needs-based, which means there's a very specific skill set that we need. And so we frequently can do research to identify that person. If you're interested in volunteering, I'd be happy to give you my card. Yeah.
Okay. I follow up. Uh-huh. Did you give some incentive to them?
Yeah. So for the volunteer, and it's particularly in the question is, did we give some incentives for the volunteers? Particularly in the farmer-to-farmer program, it is many people look at it as a learning opportunity for themselves. It's taking a skill that you know well and having to apply it in a totally different context. And so a lot of people really jump at the opportunity. As I said, you're paying nothing out of pocket to volunteer. Really what you're volunteering is your time. So you're not paying for the flight. You're not, you get like a per diem when you're there. We pay for the hotel and we handle all the logistics and everything like that. Steve, I don't know if you want to add anything about
it. How do I turn this on?
Just tap it on.
Yeah. Yeah, it's on. So let's be fair. Less than 20% of the United States even has a passport. And if you give them a lot of people an opportunity to go to exotic places like Malawi or Mozambique and do something and help people that they're only seeing on television, there's a lot of the population in the United States is like, I don't have to actually put really too much thought into this, and all I have to do is bring my expertise. People jump at that. And then additionally, our best recruiters are actually other volunteers. They come back to the United States and they say, I had a wonderful time when I went to Bangladesh. And so, really, I mean, we look at any opportunities we can. We don't go a lot of places, but we send a lot of emails to universities, to ag businesses, to we just got in contact with, it was one of the big ag conglomerates, not Monsanto, but another one. And we're talking.
Grace?
No, that wasn't it. Could something. Cadiza? Sorry. It's been a couple of weeks. And they said, yeah, you know, we will be happy to donate our employees' time to have them go and assist internationally if you will pay for all the other stuff. They will pay for 2 weeks' worth of vacation for that volunteer to go over so they don't have to use their annual leave, so they can still use it over Christmas and for their own time. So we find a lot of different unique ways to try to find volunteers.
Yeah.
I just want to take a second to hear before I could. You might also note if you want to chat, we have the electronic newsletter. And so every month, I work with the Vice President, Dr. Mitchum, but we actually try to post volunteer assignments from these and other agencies every month that are horticulture related. So if you check our electronic, it's a good place to start, then you should go look at their things. But there's a lot of really nice rewards here. Fortunately, I've been to all of these things for volunteer assignments. So I've been to Mozambique with Santa Fe, and I've been to Guinea with Denmark. So there's really wonderful opportunities here. So, but that's not all there is. So there's many different things to do, and it really is very rewarding to be able to go do that and see those places and help people. They'll come back and tell about it.
To know a little bit about the challenges maybe faced or have been experienced by the volunteers, they're exposed to different cultures and all that stuff. And second, Steve, I think you mentioned 91, the Windrock is started, and I don't know exactly the CNFA and all these that were USAID implemented agencies. So my question is that second, the impact on all of these countries, where do you see that in like maybe last 10 or 40 years that really that it has gone in particular this sector and has really impacted in agriculture development, and now these countries are out of that, and all that maybe agribusiness or any other area. So yeah, anything on the impact you are not thinking?
Yeah.
there are lots of reports on the online, probably I can find. But, thank you. But this was a wonderful presentation from both of
you. You want to go first? Do you want me to go first?
I don't really have any solid numbers that I can share with you. Say, like, you know, in 2015 it was 14 and now it's 30. I don't have any solid numbers like that, but I can say that the technology that's been brought, some of the very simple technology that was not existent when I first got off the plane in Zimbabwe in 1999, have changed Africa substantially, including and not limited to the agricultural sector. Well, the biggest one I can see is information and technology as far as tablets, cell phones, smartphones. I was in Bangladesh last year, and the vast majority of the people in the city had smartphones. You got just outside of that, and people had phones. At least they had phones. Now, 20 years ago, when I got outside the city, people didn't have shoes. Like adults didn't have shoes. Now there's many people with cell phone connectivity. And if they don't have it in their village, they've at least got it in their local shopping area. And that allows them to get a much better value for their product than just getting ripped off by some farm gate middleman. So I do see, now I've been back and forth to Africa many different times to about 20 different countries. And I've definitely seen an improvement in the last 20 years that I wouldn't have noticed as much if I had just gone straight 20 years there. So a good example of that is last night, for whatever reason, I was watching a YouTube video, and it was on the History Channel, and they were talking about what a great technology the beeper was. You know, the little box that told you got a message? Well, everything's on our phone now.
So in terms of the impact of our programs, there's no one from USAID in the room, right? So I'll be honest with you. I take when I look at our programs, my primary objective is I want to do well by the people who we're trying to help, meaning the people who we're working with directly. And that's not always a given. I can come up with lots of examples of sort of unintended consequences of some of the work that has been done in the past. And so really trying to learn from those and make sure that when we work with someone directly, that we are actually giving them information, knowledge, teaching them how to apply it, and giving them things that they can use. And so, you know, on that, there's lots of successful examples. Things like businesses that have taken off. I visited a friend last weekend who had a baby recently. I can actually go to the store here in D.C. and buy a baby toy that's produced in Bangladesh by a company that Winrock helped start. There are a lot of successes like that. To the larger question about turning changing an economy, changing an entire country, pulling them out of the development or out of the need for development, there are also a lot of examples of that. India is one where in part with development assistance, but also a ton of investment from the government, from the private sector, it's undergone a bit of a green revolution. In terms of, but at the same time, I would also say, and kind of to Steve's point, the goalposts are always moving on that.
Yes.
So what we think of as developed today is very different than what we would have thought of for a country to be developed 20 years ago. The key is that we always want to be moving forward. Again, within specific countries or projects, I could probably give you some numbers on that. But and to your question about the challenges that volunteers have, one of them is honestly just a culture shock. Every country is different. If you're going to Uzbekistan, you're probably going to be surprised at how developed it is with what you have in the picture that you have in your mind. Guinea, I can be honest, is probably one of the least developed countries where we work, where it's even in the capital city, you're not guaranteed running water, you're not guaranteed electricity all the time. Once you leave the capital city, as I said, it's 300 kilometers to our project site, and it can take you up to 12 hours to get there because of the condition of the roads. And so that's really kind of the big one is how flexible can you be if you get somewhere and the water isn't going to run for the first 3 days that you're there? Can you adapt to that, or is that just a bit too much for you? The other one is that these are, a lot of times the organizations that you're helping can be sort of loosely formed organizations. They can be like an agriculture federation, something like that. And so when you get there, it may have been one person in that organization who has developed the scope of work, and then you might actually be working with different people who maybe have different expectations or have different objectives, or they may have an emergency. You know, they may get there and say, our tomatoes are being decimated by this disease. That wasn't in the scope of work. And so having the flexibility to adapt to that and kind of pivot to make sure that we're meeting the needs of the people on the ground. Those are, I think, sort of the two biggest challenges.
But there's also, like you were saying, there's also some real successes regionally. Some examples are, I mean, think 50 years ago, you didn't think that Nigeria would be making movies or India would be making movies or Senegal would have the economy that it does. Botswana, Namibia, I mean, there are as many examples internationally. I'm not so familiar with Asia, but Kenya is another one where you've got these regional hub countries that are really doing much better than they were many years ago. So the goalposts are moving, and it takes time. So you have to give it the time that it needs. In some places, it takes longer.
Question for Peter about the youth engagement piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
You talked about Guinea.
Mm-hmm.
Are you working just in Guinea with youth engagement, or are some of those same programs transferable across different geographies?
Yeah, so they're absolutely transferable. Most of our programs are either funded by USAID or USDA, and so each program is different. We certainly have objectives to reach young people in various programs. I mentioned our farmer to farmer. We're doing ag education and training, which means a large number of the people we're working with are young people. We have programs all over in Mozambique. We are working with young tractor owners, people who've been given tractors from the government, and we're actually working with a U.S.-based company called Hello Tractor, which bills itself as the Uber of tractors, and piloting their units on those tractors there so that they can actually develop a business out of that tractor and make enough money so that when they get a flat tire, they can actually get the tire fixed. And so, it's absolutely transferable. I think what's a little bit different about this one is that typically we think of the young people as beneficiaries. And in this program, we're actually treating the young people as implementers. So where we are working through them and putting them front and center as the face of the program. And I think this is something that has really – so, you know, typically we're saying we want to work. We want to train the young people. We want to do these things for them. But as I said, we're actually giving them the technologies and asking them to distribute and sell those technologies. And to teach people how to use them and integrate those technologies into businesses, which is something that in a typical program our staff are primarily doing. But again, when we talk about this, we talk about not just in Guinea, but in Mozambique or in Zimbabwe, or when you talk about why young people don't want to work in agriculture, it's because they say, you know, I can do something with my phone and I can move to the city and have a better quality of life, or I can work in the fields all day. And the way I look at it is the farming of the future, whether it's the U.S., Guinea, doesn't actually require as many farmers because of technology, because of efficiencies. And so we're trying to pivot them into that technology and service sector so that they can find opportunities there that are ag-adjacent or ag-related that are not necessarily production.